Hello, this is Beverly Tomasian. I'd like to welcome all of you to the fourth in our series of Diabetes Fundamentals classes. And this webcast today is Medications for Type 2 Diabetes. And I've been teaching this course for over 20 years. And when I started 20 years ago, we just had one class of medications, sulfonylureas. And now there's been an explosion and we have, you know, half a dozen classes of oral medications that we can utilize to help get glucose to goal. But sometimes all those, you know, that big availability of medications can be overwhelming. So the purpose of this webcast is to really help hone in on what these different classes of medications are, what they do, what are some of the considerations, and we'll start exploring what medications match which patients. There is a second level to this program. Well, it's part of our Level 2 series where we talk more about using algorithms to determine which medications match which patients. So for this course, we're focusing more on what are these medications, how do they work, what are some of the basic principles and considerations. And I think this is a really great place to get started. And I've just updated this program based on the new ADA standards of care that were released in 2015. And I must say the new standards are very well written and worth your read. And they have an excellent section on managing hyperglycemia for type 1 and type 2. And they have some really excellent algorithms. I'll be referring to those during this program, but also I would encourage you to go to our resource page and download you know, that information that I have listed there to augment what I talk about in this webcast. And so let's get started. We'll just launch right in because we have a lot of great information to cover. When we think about diabetes oral agents, we want to know that diabetes medications can be used by themselves, monotherapy, or in combination with each other, and they can also be used with insulin. So we don't really have a standardized way of starting medications. We do know a few things, which I'll be going over in a few minutes. But after a certain point, we don't have enough evidence gathered to determine what is the best strategy for people. And so we're still in this mode of figuring out what works, and we're developing algorithms to determine which steps to take next. But it's still evolving. Combination agents from different classes have additive effects. So if one medication isn't doing its job, adding another one synergistically can really help lower A1C. So generally we don't say stop a medication and start a new one. We say add the medications to each other. Synergistically they work better. Really exciting is that these oral medications and some injectables can lower A1C by 0.5 to 2%. Now we know that a 1% A1C is 30 points of blood sugar. So if I drop my A1C 2 percentage points, I drop my blood sugar 60 points. So these medications can be very effective. If I only drop my A1C 0.5, we know that I'm only dropping my blood sugars about 15 points. Now this last bullet point is a little bit controversial, but currently the American Diabetes Association says there's not enough evidence to say use of these medications during preconception, pregnancy, or when best breastfeeding is safe. So they don't endorse it. But there are many institutions that will have patients who are pregnant on metformin or sulfonylureas. And so that's an institutionally based recommendation. But right now the American Diabetes Association still does not endorse that officially. The really exciting thing about this webcast is that the ADA has really made a change in their position. And they used to talk a lot about pathophysiology of diabetes directing what medications to utilize. But now they really have identified that it's more than just a pathophysiology. We want to consider the patient. So on that note, what I'd like to do is launch my first poll and ask you all this question. Which factors are most important to consider when matching medications to patients? What do you think are some factors that we should consider? And you can choose more than one answer. All right. Well, you guys are fast. There's like silence and then boom, you chose the answers. Thank you. Thanks for voting. It really helps me because I'm so used to presenting in, you know, live and in person. So It really helps me to get these polls back. Okay, 90% of you have voted. So let's go ahead and share this. So 90% of you chose all of the above, and that is the right answer. When we're thinking about what medications match which patients, we have to consider, can they afford it, their insurance coverage? Very important. I've had so many situations where my patients were prescribed meds they couldn't afford, so they didn't take it. And their ability to self-manage, can they take this medication safely? Do they know the side effects? And are they willing to take medications? Some of our patients may say, I don't really want to take medications, or I'll take one. We're going to do a lot of negotiation with them. And then their glucose history is really important too. You know, let's look at what their blood sugars have been, and let's see which medications match their patterns of blood sugars. And so you all did great on that. I'm going to go ahead and hide that poll. But this is right from the position statement. We want to gauge patients' preferred level of involvement. And we want to explore where possible therapeutic choices. What does this mean? It means engaging the patient in decision making. Here are some medications that might work for you. I'm going to tell you the benefits and the side effects. Let's choose together which medications would be a best fit for you. And when we get patients' buy-in, research has shown patients are much more likely to take that medication and take it for an ongoing period of time. Share decision making. The truth is, the final decisions regarding lifestyle choices ultimately lie with the patient. We can, you know, suggest and prescribe and do all this stuff, but ultimately, it's the person living with diabetes every day that's going to choose to do these things or not do these activities. And so we want to engage them in the decision-making process as much as possible. And I really love this opening paragraph. We want to provide care that is respectful and responsive to individual patient preferences, needs, and values. We want to ensure that patient values guide all clinical decisions. So this is a nice paradigm, a framework for us to work from when I'm meeting with our patients. The ADA Standards of Care also has this image inside under the Medication and Management of Hyperglycemia section. And I think it's really nice to take a look at. So it says, approach to the management of hyperglycemia, more stringent, moving that A1C less than 7%, less stringent. So who would we be less stringent with is a good question. And so I'll just tell you that the ADA says for patients who are older, have a lot of cardiovascular disease, high risk for hypoglycemia, and don't have a limited life expectancy and have established complications, we may let that A1C trend up all the way to 8%. But for our younger population, healthy people that are coming in newly diagnosed with diabetes, we're going to work for an A1C goal of less than 7%, more to, you know, the 6-ish range. So this A1C is flexible and needs to be based on where the patient is at. And you can see looking at these different areas really helps us to strategize where our patients are at. So if they are high risk for hypoglycemia, we might be a little bit less stringent. But if they're low risk, we can do more medication management. Newly diagnosed, we want to be very aggressive. There's all kinds of studies showing that for newly diagnosed patients, the more aggressive we are on managing their blood sugars, the better we protect their remaining beta cells. So early in the disease duration, we want to be very aggressive. If they've had long-standing diabetes 10, 20, 30 years, we want to kind of consider what would be a realistic A1C goal. Here's life expectancy, comorbidities, vascular complications, patient attitude, so important. If they're highly motivated, adherent, they have excellent self-care skills, we can really load on the medications and involve them in the process and decision-making. But if they're less motivated, we're going to have to approach it differently and maybe keep it more simple and check in with them about what are they realistically able to do. Resources, I just can't state how important this is. They have good insurance, they have a good family support system, you know, they have access to healthy food, then we can work on more stringent A1C targets. But if it's limited, we may have to relax those a little bit. And so this, I think, is a good guideline for us. The A1C target is less than 7% for most people, but we modify that based on what they're able to do. When we think about, you know, managing those blood sugars, what we want to really consider first is lifestyle changes. So this isn't a position statement. Enter anti-hyperglycemic therapy, first step. Let's get them into a dietitian. As you know, dietitians are wildly effective at lowering A1C. They can lower A1C, you know, after a patient receives intervention from a registered dietitian, they can lower their A1Cs 1 to 2 percentage point. Healthy eating makes a big difference. Losing weight, getting active, attending diabetes self-management education programs, all of these are the first step in helping patients manage their diabetes. So that's a given. And then the next step is medications. So what we're going to talk about is the different medications that are available to manage type 2 diabetes. And what I'd like you to do right now, if you can, is get your diabetes medication pocket cards, because we'll be referring to those during this webcast. You can download them from our website. It's under resources, pocket cards, and print them out. And if you don't have your own personal copy, we'll be happy to mail them to you. Just request that, and we mail them out every few weeks. So we lick and stuff and stamp envelopes, a lot of them, every week to make sure we get these cards out to you. It's really important to us. So here on the left-hand side are the different classes of type 2 medications, and here are the official names. So this is what they do on the left side. This is their classification on the right-hand side. So I'm going to go over these just to give us a roadmap of where we're going to go, and then we'll drill down each of these. But I just feel like since this is so much information, repetition is really helpful, and giving a big view and then narrowing it down to the individual medications is really helpful. So the first one here we have is the suppressor. So I made up these words to help remember what these drugs do. The suppressor is suppressing what? The liver. It stops the glycogen release from the liver. And the drug in this category, and if you look at your oral medications pocket card, the purple one, is metformin. So metformin's primary job is to stop the liver from making so much extra sugar. The second class are the squirters. So when you think about squirters, what am I talking about? Well, these are medications that stimulate the pancreas to squirt insulin. And if you look at your card, those are the next two, the gliburide and the glipizide and the glimepiride it's the second one on the card, are the sulfonylureas. We also have another one called the meglitinides. Those are on the back of your card. They're not used that much. Prandin and Starlix. So this class of medication tells the pancreas to make insulin. Third class of medication, I kind of term the satiators. What does that mean, satiators? Well, you feel satisfied. You're full. It gives us a sense of fullness. As you know, 90% of people with type 2 diabetes are overweight, and they're thinking that maybe they're not getting a message to the brain that you're full. Stop eating. And so these medications help manage blood sugars through satiation and other gut hormones. The first one we have is an amylinomimetic. What is that? Well, whenever you see the word mimetic, it means imitator. So if you look at the back of your green card, you'll see at the bottom the injectables at lower glucose. It says amylin mimetic. Now, amylin is a hormone made by the pancreas that causes satiation and tells the pancreas to make insulin. We'll go over that more. We also have the incretin mimetics. What does that mean? Well, they're gut hormone imitators, and they're also known as GLP-1 agonists. Those are our Byetta, Victoza, Tanzium, Trulicity. These are the medications that imitate our gut hormones. And then we have the DPP-4 inhibitors. So if you go to your oral medications card on the front, the DPP-4 inhibitors include Januvia, Onglyza, Tradjenta, and Nucina. They help improve our levels of gut hormone, and so they're very important in this arsenal of medications to help improve glucose levels. So the satiators. Now we have the sensitizers. Those are the thiazolidinediones. If you look on the back of your blue card, those are Actos and Avandia. They actually open up the cell to let it use insulin. We have the glucoretics. I love that term, glucoretic. I wish I would have made it up, but I didn't. Because gluco means sugar, and retic, like diuretic, means, you know, to eliminate. So these medications are glucuretics. They help us urinate out sugar. They're the new class, the SGLT2 inhibitors, and there's actually three of them. If you look on the back of your purple card, Invokana, Farxiga, and Jardiance. So those medications help us to eliminate sugar in our urine. We have on the sixth one here, circadian switchers. Now, these are the dopamine receptor agonists. We don't talk about them too much, but it's the quick-release cyclocet, and they actually increase dopamine levels, which helps to lower blood sugars. And the last one, the slowers, are the alpha-glucosidase inhibitors. It's on the back of your purple card again. And these actually help delay absorption of carbohydrate in the intestine. And because they delay absorption, you don't get this postprandial spike. It's known as acarbose. So these are the different classes of medications that we have. There's a lot of them. And so as you go through, you know, doing diabetes education, you want to just bring these cards with you, these medication pocket cards, find out what patients are on, what the doses are, and just, you know, really ask questions about these medications so you become more comfortable and familiar with them. Because what I've found in my experience is that patients are my best teachers about medications. They give me a lot of feedback about what works, what doesn't work, and they can really help direct their own care. You know, when patients check their blood sugars and bring us their logbook, they help us direct their care because we can see where their blood sugars are low, where they're high, and it gives us information to help us coach them in new ways. And one of those coaching strategies, besides, you know, eating differently and exercise, is adjustment of medication. Well, speaking of medications, I want to ask you all another question, and that is, what are qualities of an ideal diabetes medication? If you were to invent your ideal diabetes medication, which of these qualities would you include in it? All right, 80% of you have voted, 90%, thank you so much. I'm going to go ahead and close this poll. Okay, let's just share. So what are some ideal qualities of the ideal diabetes medication? And 67% of you said no weight gain or some weight loss. Absolutely. We know that 90% of people with diabetes are overweight. So if we can see that that medication is associated with no weight gain or some weight loss, we love that. Affordable, big deal. People with diabetes are often on many other medications. You know, the older we get, the more likely we are to get diabetes. So a lot of our population is older, non-fixed incomes, and they may not have the best insurance. This is kind of, so affordable is definitely an ideal quality. C was a juicy answer. Only causes hypoglycemia once a week. We really want a medication that does not cause hypoglycemia, especially for our frail elderly patients, you know, who are at high risk for lows. We want to make sure that this medication is safe for them. So no hypoglycemia would be the goal. And then D, it causes a slight increase in LDL. Well, as it turns out, LDL is a bad cholesterol. It's called lousy or lethal cholesterol. It's a low-density lipoprotein, so we don't want that to increase at all. We want that to stay neutral or improve. And 90% of you chose lower cardiovascular risk. You're absolutely right. Diabetes is really considered a cardiovascular condition. So we know that people with diabetes, the number one cause of death is heart attack and stroke. And so whatever we can do to protect their vasculature and their blood vessels is really important. So if a diabetes medication can also, you know, decrease or mitigate cardiovascular risk, that's a real benefit. And so here we are with our ideal diabetes medication. No hypoglycemia, no weight gain, maybe some weight loss, affordable, lowers heart risk, and most people can tolerate or use. And I would add to this last one is that you only have to take it maybe once a week. Is that possible? Is there a medication out there you only need to take once a week? Well, we're going to find out. So let's start with our first medication here, the biguanide known as metformin. And it does suppress the release of glycogen from the liver. So the liver is a big glycogen warehouse. It stores, you know, it stores energy for future use. And the liver actually is quite guilty of releasing its stored glycogen during the night. So a lot of our patients with diabetes might wake up with morning fasting hyperglycemia. And that is because that their liver is releasing sugar all night. And when their liver releases sugar all night, they wake up with those high mornings. So metformin is in particularly effective at getting morning fasting blood sugars down. Metformin is also really good at helping to treat dysmetabolic syndrome. What does that mean? Well, that's a syndrome where you have high blood sugars, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol, because metformin not only lowers blood sugars, but it also lowers LDL cholesterol. It is the only FDA-approved medication, oral medication, for kids. It's FDA-approved for the regular version for kids starting at age 10, and if extended release, they can start at age 17. So I call this the glycogen stopper and GLP enhancer. Well, I have a question mark by GLP enhancer, but there's some new research that shows that metformin actually does seem to increase the availability of gut hormones. And so that's pretty exciting. So we know that it stops the liver from releasing glucose, but new research shows that it might also support the creation and utilization of the body's gut hormones. So the starting dose usually for metformin is 500 milligrams twice a day. The max dose is 2,500 milligrams a day. And I do want to say a lot of patients are just started on regular metformin. I'm trying, working with my providers and coaching, to say start them on metformin XR. Metformin XR, it stands for extended release, and it works way better as far as reducing the risk of side effects. So there's less side effects. And the particular side effect is nausea, bloating, you know, stomach upset. Metformin extended release rarely causes those side effects that often really stop people from taking metformin. So always go for the metformin XR. It doesn't cost anymore, and they just take it at dinner time. And the max dose for the extended release version is 2,000 milligrams a day generally. So it can be, you know, 500 or 1,000 milligrams twice, two pills in the evening, and sometimes patients split it up and take some in the morning and the evening. But really, you can just take it once a day, and that works really well. The pills are just large. That's the biggest issue with them. But look how efficacious metformin is. It decreases fasting plasma glucose 60 to 70 points, and actually it has a dose responsiveness curve. So the more metformin you take, the better it lowers your blood sugar, and it reduces A1C 1 to 2 percentage points. The benefits of metformin, as I've mentioned, it decreases LDL cholesterol and triglycerides, no weight gain. Some people lose weight on it, and there's some research that shows it may actually be cancer protective. People with diabetes are much at greater risk for breast, liver, and pancreas cancer, and there's some studies showing that metformin might help reduce that risk. So the concerns with metformin: diarrhea, abdominal discomfort, use extended release, and lactic acidosis is an issue. Now, lactic acidosis can occur if the kidneys aren't working well and this medication is prescribed. The kidneys help to clear metformin. So if the kidneys are sluggish, if the creatinine is elevated, the medication metabolites may not be able to be removed, and they can build up in the bloodstream and cause lactic acidosis. So we want to make sure that the kidneys are working well when we prescribe this medication, and I'll give you guidelines in a minute. Now, when I say prescribe medication, I want to clarify that I'm a diabetes, you know, educator and a nurse, and so I don't prescribe. I don't have prescriptive authority, but certainly as diabetes educators, we make suggestions to providers about medication changes and additions. So that's what I'm, you know, mentioning right now. And we can look to see which patients match which medications. Long-term metformin therapy has been associated with some B12 deficiency. So if your patients are complaining of nerve pain and they're on metformin, we might want to consider B12 replacement. There's no suggestion that we measure B12 on everyone. We just kind of look for symptoms. If they're complaining of, you know, nerve pain, which is a manifestation of B12 deficiency, we suggest starting B12 supplementation. We also want to hold metformin prior to IV contrast dye studies and use caution during acute illness. That's why when patients are admitted to the hospital setting, we often see that they're not started on metformin if they are on metformin, they're taken off because we want to make sure that their kidneys are functioning well, and then we can resume when they're in a stable place. So here's the contraindications to metformin based on creatinine. So here's a creatinine cutoff, 1.4 for females, 1.5 for males. Other considerations, if they have liver disease, if they're drinking more than 2 drinks a day or binging, and over 80 years of age, you can see all of these. But the interesting thing is the ADA standards actually suggest that, yes, let's look at creatinine, but maybe we should also look at GFR. It may be a more appropriate measure. So GFR is a glomerular filtration rate, and you can look at it on the labs. You'll see it, or there's different computer programs, online resources where you can calculate out GFR when you plug in data like their creatinine and their age and ethnicity. But if the GFR is less than 45, max dose is 1,000 milligrams a day, and if GFR is less than 30, stop metformin. So that's interesting. If they have a GFR, 55, it says metformin is still okay for them. Even if their GFR is lower, less than 45, they can still take metformin, but we just want to not exceed 1,000 milligrams. So I think when I'm working with my patients now, I'll look at creatinine, but I'll also look at GFR to give me more information about safety for this particular patient. So now I'd like to ask you a series of questions. How does metformin rate, and does it cause low blood sugar? No, it doesn't. Does it cause weight gain? No, metformin does not cause weight gain. Some patients lose weight on it. Is it affordable? Actually, metformin is very affordable. We'll talk about this in a minute, but you can get a 3-month supply for under $10 if you're cash pay. So absolutely affordable. Does it lower cardiovascular risk? Yeah, it does, because it can improve LDL cholesterol. Can most people tolerate? And I would say yes, especially the extended release, but for patients on the regular metformin, they may have more trouble. So really encouraging providers to start with extended release is a great way to go. And if they're on the regular metformin, moving them over can really help improve. So this is from the ADA guidelines, and I just added this to the handouts this morning, so your handout may not have this, but you can, write these notes down. It's also in the ADA standards of care, so it exists in many places. But the ADA says, here's a stepwise approach to hyperglycemia. Start with lifestyle coaching, making sure they get to the dietitian and diabetes self-management education, focusing on exercise, weight loss, healthy eating. But it says when lifestyle alone is not achieving A1C goal, metformin should be added at or soon after diagnosis. So sometimes we'll start a patient on metformin plus lifestyle changes. Sometimes if their A1C is just above the target, maybe at 6.6, we may say, let's just try you on, changing your lifestyle and improving your lifestyle, and we'll start metformin if that number starts to go up. But obviously if the A1C is in the 8s, we're going to say we really need to get some metformin on board. Metformin has a long-standing evidence base for efficacy and safety. It's been around for over 40 years. It's cheap, and it actually may reduce cardiovascular risk. If A1C target is not achieved after 3 months, we want to consider adding one of the other 6 treatment options or basal insulin. So we'll try metformin for 3 months, but if that A1C is not below our target of 7, we need to add a second agent. And this is a really good point that they added. This is a new addition from last year in the ADA standards. For all patients, consider initiating dual therapy if the A1C is 9% or greater. So if a patient comes into you and their A1C is 9% or greater, that tells us that their pancreas is really struggling, and certainly they might benefit from 2 medications, or maybe even oral medication and some basal insulin to get them out of glucose toxicity. These are the ADA standards of care. This came right out of the standards of care, so you can open that document and take a look at it. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it during this webcast. On the level two, we will go over it in a lot more detail. But I just want to show you that this framework exists, and it's a helpful framework for us. So they say start with healthy eating, weight control, physical activity, education. And metformin is the number one drug of choice, if not contraindicated. But if those blood sugars are still up after 3 months and the A1C is not at target, then we're going to consider adding one of these other agents, which we'll be going over. And here to the left, they look at how efficacious is it, what's the risk of low, what's the weight consequence, what are the side effects, and what are the costs. So this helps to inform us when we're sitting down with that patient deciding which medication best matches you. We're going to look at what their situation is and what their limitations are and look at these medications and find the best match based on what the patient brings to the table. If that still doesn't work, dual therapy, we're going to have to go to triple therapy. And if triple therapy still doesn't achieve goal, so this is interesting to note, that we try three meds, and after three meds are not working, they really do suggest to go to metformin plus insulin or GLP. What is a GLP? Glucagon-like peptide agonist. We'll talk about that in a minute. And so this gives us a nice framework to work from when determining what medications best match our patients. This is from the American Association of Clinical Endocrinology. This article is also listed on your resource page. This looks at the glycemic control algorithm. Similar to ADA, they say start with lifestyle modification, number one. But then they look at it a little bit differently. They look at what is the A1C, and based on what the A1C is on diagnosis, that's where we start therapy. But regardless, if the entry A1C is less than 7.5, metformin is the drug of choice. So now they've listed these medications not by when they were discovered like the ADA does. They list them by best on top. So metformin is the king, and then you'll see as they go down, these other medications are in a stepwise fashion. You know, their efficacy is listed here. But metformin is number one. But if the A1C is more than 7.5, start metformin and add one of these. And then they say over here, if the A1C is more than 9%, we're going to start dual or triple therapy if there's no symptoms. But if symptoms, we're going to start insulin or other agents. So as I mentioned, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this now. But we're going to talk about it more in the second part of this series and the medications. But this is a really nice algorithm for you to take a look at. And you can take a look at the ADA algorithm and the AACE algorithm and read through their papers. And it definitely gives you some ideas about strategies to improve blood sugars. The purpose of this, you know, program is to kind of give you a solid foundation about what these medications do, contraindications, and really getting a good understanding of their basic function. Let's do a life study right now, though. We have a 59-year-old overweight woman with type 2 diabetes for 3 years. She has been trying to control her diabetes with diet and exercise, but her A1C is 8.4%. Based on this information, what medication would you suggest she get started on? So I'm going to launch this as a poll. And you can go ahead and choose the answer that you think is right. Okay, 70% of you have voted. Thank you, everyone. 80%. I'm going to go ahead and close this poll, and I'm seeing some notices that some of you are having trouble seeing my screen, and I do sincerely apologize. So I went off air, and I'm back on air again, and I'm hoping that has improved, that you can see my screen now. The great thing about technology is that it's awesome that we can, you know, share this across the country without you driving anywhere, but sometimes there are limitations too. So I hope that helped a little bit. Let's keep going with that. So let's just share this poll. So 100% of you said you would choose metformin therapy, and that is exactly right. In this situation, this woman has diabetes for 3 years. She's trying to control her diabetes, and her A1C is up. Metformin would be the great, perfect choice for her. And you might even be wondering, why did they wait so long to start metformin therapy? And I see that a lot in my practice too. I think that, you know, really sometimes we wait too long to be more aggressive. And the truth is, the earlier on in the disease process we help get those blood sugars down, the better the outcomes are. So if we can identify these patients whose A1Cs are elevated and make suggestions to providers to start metformin therapy or intensify management, that is really helpful for our patients. And that's part, a lot of what we do is that we advocate for our patients. And we advocate for our patients. I'm just looking at your notes to me, and we really encourage them to, you know, we encourage their advocacy with their providers to improve their diabetes management. Okay, so I'm seeing that you guys are still having trouble seeing my screen, and so I'm going to try again to show my screen and see if this helps. The good thing about it, I mean, what you could do if you're not able to see the screen, at least you have the handouts you can refer to during the presentation. So I know it's not ideal, and I really appreciate your patience. So we'll do our best and keep going. Sulfonurias. Sulfonurias are the next class of agents if we look at our cards. And they actually tell the pancreas to keep squirting. So here's the squirt sign. And it's telling what? The pancreas to keep squirting insulin. And the pancreas squirts insulin 24 hours a day. When they take this medication, it doesn't just tell to squirt with meals. It's telling the pancreas keep squirting insulin all day long. And if you can imagine what the problem is with that, you're not eating all the time. And especially if you take this medication before breakfast, and maybe you eat a small breakfast and you're late getting to lunch, you may not, your blood sugars might drop because you didn't get enough carbohydrates to cover the medication, because it's telling the pancreas to keep squirting insulin even though you're not eating. And that's sometimes the risk of this medication, that patients do get low blood sugar. And so this is really important when patients come in on sulfonurias, glipizide, glyburide, glimepiride, to make sure they know when you take this medication, you have to eat, and you really cannot afford to skip meals. Your blood sugar can get too low. So this medication, sulfonurias, is really best suited for lean type 2s. Why do I say that? Because we know on average people gain about 5 to 10 pounds when they take these medications. And so this weight gain is not welcome. I'm already overweight. I'm going on a medication that actually even increases my weight more. There are some lean type 2s, I work with them, and what, they're really insulin deficient. They're not making enough insulin, and this medication is a good match for them. The truth is, this medication is very effective. It lowers the fasting plasma glucose 60 to 70 points and reduces the A1C by 1 to 2 percentage point. So it is effective. It lowers blood sugar. It works with most people. After 5 years, it might diminish in its efficacy, and it's really cheap. So it has a lot of good benefits to it. But the biggest drawback is that hypoglycemia and the weight gain. Here's the second generation sulfonurias. I'm not listing the first generations anymore because we rarely see those used. We have the generic glyburide, known as Diabeta or Micronase. You can see these medications work for up to 24 hours. The ADA position statement has stated that this medication, the sulfonuria, is most likely to cause hypoglycemia. So it is the last choice when determining which medication to use for which patients. So this is the last choice of medication we're going to use as far as sulfonurias. It has the most the highest risk of hypoglycemia. Glipizide is probably the safest one, especially the regular version, the glucotrol, and it only lasts for about a half a day, 12 hours. And so if you have patients with any renal problems or high risk for hypoglycemia, that's the best choice. The extended release version, Glucotrol XL, lasts for 24 hours, and I would not recommend that with any patient with renal problems. These drugs are cleared by the kidneys, so if the kidneys aren't working well, the drugs stay in the bloodstream for a long period of time and can cause hypoglycemia. Amaryl, a long-acting version of a sulfonylurea, lasts for 24 hours, and it is the safest for those with cardiovascular disease. There's this other issue with cardiac remodeling and sulfonylurea. So if your patients do have heart disease, Amaryl would be the best choice within this class. So sulfonylureas, very effective, but have two serious consequences, hypoglycemia and weight gain, cleared by kidneys, so not recommended for anybody with kidney problems, but they are very inexpensive. So that's one of their major benefits. Now, in addition to sulfonylureas, we have two medications called miglitinides that are fast-acting insulin secretagogues. Now, I have a picture of a rabbit on this slide because these medications jump in and get to work and jump back out. So the miglitinides you take before each meal, and it will help your pancreas squirt out insulin for 2 to 4 hours, and then the effect of the medication wears off. So it does target postprandial hyperglycemia. It has a better safety profile because it's not in the blood, you know, for 24 hours. It just gets in and does its job and then hops back out. The problem with these fast-acting miglitinides, known as Prandin and Starlix, is that you have to take it with every meal. And so the potential to forget the medication is there. And so that's the hassle factor. The other problem with these medications is insurance companies were reluctant to cover them because they said, why should we cover this more expensive medication that we could use sulfonylureas and get the same results? So they really never took off, and they're rarely used, but it's good for us to know that they're out there. I'd like to ask you another poll question, and that is, which of the following medications are cheapest for management of type 2 diabetes? I am so glad you can all see the screen now. Thank you for your patience, and I really appreciate it. Okay, 80% of you have voted. Which of the following meds are cheapest? Let's take one more second to vote. I'm going to close this and share with you. So, Actos and Avandia, interestingly enough, are now generic, but they are still expensive. They can cost, you know, $30 to $60 a month. The glipizide, glyburide, glimepiride, sulfonylureas are very cheap. So those and metformin are the two cheapest medications out there. Any new medication like the Januvia, Onglyzer, Bydureon, and Victoza are very expensive. And so all new medications cost a lot of money. And when I say a lot of money, I want to say if you had to pay out of pocket $200 to $300 a month. And I did some research in my own community to see, you know, how much of these medications cost. So I called around to different pharmacies in my area, and I found the following: go generic. That's the best thing we can do to help our patients. I have patients in the donut hole. I have patients who are cash pay. I have patients who have such a high deductible, it's cheaper to buy the medications cash. So you want to evaluate that with your patients. Metformin and sulfonylureas are the cheapest, and Walmart, you know, does offer a lot of great resources for people with diabetes, and they make it affordable. They offer a 3-month supply of the following medications for $10, metformin and metformin XR, and the sulfonylureas. Other generics include Actos, Navandi, and Acarbose, but they can still cost up to $100 a month. And so if you click on this link, it goes to my Medications on a Budget article, which talks about this issue of the expense of medications and how it's really closing a lot of our patients out of, you know, getting the care that they need. This is just some aglitinides I talked about, and looking at the Prandin and the Starlix. And these medications do lower the A1C 1 to 2 percentage points, but again, they're not really being used that much. I do want to point out that Prandin is metabolized by the liver and excreted mostly in the feces. So if patients have renal problems, this is a great choice for them. It really, you know, helps prevent that hypoglycemia. And the I'll just say one more thing about the meglitinides. They do cause minimal weight gain and less hypoglycemia since they just work when you take them with the meals. So they really do offer that benefit. Okay, so let's just rate the squirters. When I say the squirters, I'm talking about the sulfonylureas and the meglitinides. Do they cause hypoglycemia? Yep, they do. Do they cause weight gain? Yep. They do. The sulfonylureas, like I said, 5-7 pounds. Meglitinides, less. Are they affordable? Well, yeah, the sulfonylureas are very affordable. Prandin and Starlix are still very expensive. Do they lower cardiovascular risk? Nope, they don't. They do help lower blood sugars and A1C, but that's not a direct impact on cardiovascular risk. They don't do anything separately than lower blood sugars to improve outcomes cardiovascularly. Like metformin lowers LDL. That's why we can say it reduces cardiovascular risk, but these drugs do not. Can most people tolerate? Yeah, they're pretty tolerable, but they have those side effects of low blood sugar and hypoglycemia. And so when I think about rating these medications, like if you would rate them 1 out of 5, 5 being the best, we would think about giving metformin probably 5 stars. And maybe the squirters here, you know, I'm going to give 3 stars. I'm going to give them 3 stars because they work really great and they're effective and they're, you know, have a good safety profile, but they do cause that low blood sugar and weight gain. Let's do another poll question. We have a 72-year-old. She's thin. She lives alone. Her A1C is 7.3. She has a history of an MI and a stroke. She's had diabetes for 12 years. She tells you she's diet controlled, and she has limited outcome. Her creatinine is 1.4. So based on that, what is the best actions we could take? There could be more than one right answer here. Oh. Okay, thanks, you guys. I got your message that the screen disappears after polls, so now I know how to fix that. Okay, so you're now voting. 72-year-old, then lives alone, history of MI and stroke, diet controlled. What is the best action? Which of the following are the best actions? She looks pretty worried, too. I'm going to close this and go ahead and launch the and share with you what you all said. So 14% said start metformin. So let me just tell you a little bit about metformin. I didn't mention this earlier, and that metformin is not really indicated for older patients. Metformin, especially older, thinner patients, doesn't work that well. And actually, she's already thin, and metformin might promote more weight loss. So in this situation, I would not use metformin. I really stay away from metformin on any patients who are struggling to gain weight because it doesn't support that. So I would not choose A. Encourage her to lose body weight? No way. She's already lean. That's not going to help. So if somebody's already lean and their blood sugars are high, I know that probably losing additional weight's not going to help that much. It's really a sign their pancreas isn't making enough insulin. Start low-dose glipizide. I like that. So 57% of you chose that. Now, low-dose glipizide is interesting to me because she's lean, and we know that glipizide will help her gain some weight, right? And actually, I would think with her situation, her pancreas isn't making enough insulin, so this might help stimulate more insulin production, and that would match her pathology the best. But what's the problem about glipizide that you're all worried about? And I know what it is. You're worried about it causing low blood sugar. And so if she does go on glipizide, we'll certainly have to make sure she has a meter. She knows the signs of low blood sugar. And we'll have to start the dose low, very low dose, and see how that impacts her blood sugars. Okay, let's go on to D, continue current strategy and provide ongoing support and monitoring. That is also a right answer. The American Diabetes Association says for older, high-risk patients with a history of cardiovascular disease, letting the A1C trend up to 8% is okay. And that's really hard for us to adjust to because we're always used to less than 7%. But we have to look at the whole patient and what she's able to do and what her expectations are and what her limitations are. So maybe for this gal, it's just really tough for her. She's struggling. She has some dementia, maybe depression. Maybe 7.3 is an acceptable place for her to be. But what if she is more like Jack LaLanne, you know, very involved and enthusiastic and wants to get her A1C down? Then we would take a different course of action. So it really here depends on the patient. But given her situation, we could leave it where it's at. Okay, next one, E. 29% of you said consider DPP-4 inhibitor. Another great choice, which we'll go over in a minute. The DPP-4 inhibitors will not cause low blood sugar, and they just lower the A1C by about a half a percentage point, so they can be very effective at lowering blood sugars and not causing hypoglycemia. So now what I'm going to do is I'm going to stop showing screen, and then I'm going to say show my screen, and then I think you all can see the screen now. If you can't see the screen, just type me a note, but I think that's what I need to do to help you see the screen. Yes, okay. I'm on fire. Now I'm on fire. Okay, thank you so much, everybody. Okay, so let's talk about DPP-4 inhibitors. DPP-4 inhibitors, which would be a great choice for this woman, are what we call incretin enhancers. So they enhance the work of the gut hormones, which help lower blood sugars. So let's just look at these a little bit more closely. If you look at your purple cards, you'll see we have Januvia, Tradjenta, Onglyza, Nucynta. These increase insulin release with meals. And so they're very specific in that they help the pancreas produce insulin when you eat. That's a good thing. And they also suppress glucagon release. Now, glucagon is a hormone that raises blood sugars. So if we can see that happen, that really can make a big difference in getting blood glucose levels to goal. Okay, you can see that these decrease A1C by about 0.6 to 0.8. So we don't get that 1 in 2% that we saw with sulfonylureas and metformin. And so a person with very high A1C, this may not be the right choice, but for a gal like that case study we saw a minute ago, it would be helpful for her. So the DPP-4 inhibitors are weight neutral. They don't cause weight gain or weight loss, and that's another, you know, benefit of them. So these are for type 2s, and let's take a look. Their Januvia and Onglyza are eliminated via the kidney, so lower dose is needed. The other medications are metabolized differently, so you don't need to adjust the dose. But these medications do not cause weight gain, nor do they cause hypoglycemia. The thing that patients complain about the most when I talk to them is headache, runny nose, like cold-like symptoms, upper respiratory symptoms, sore throat. And these also have the warning to watch for pancreatitis. And I can see some of you are writing me notes in the question box that these are expensive medications. You are right. The other day, or about a few years ago when this medication came out, I had a patient very similar to the case study, and I was like, wow, Januvia seems like a great match for this patient. And we talked to the patient agreed. And then I got a phone call you know, saying, Beverly, this medication is so expensive, it cost me $200 for a 3-month supply. That even though it was expensive, it was worth it to the patient because he wanted to get his blood sugars down. So that was one situation. But other patients, this may not be affordable for them. So we might have to look at the glipizide, right? That low-dose glipizide, which is affordable. You could do cash pay for that and spend less than $10 over 3 months. So you can see here, as we talk about these different medications, we're considering the patient, we're considering the cost, we're considering the side effects, we're considering the whole picture. It's not just the pathophysiology. And that's a really important part of what we do as educators and advocates. Some patients have great insurance, so they have no out-of-pocket costs for this. So it's, you know, with the new Affordable Care Act, things have really shifted in the landscape of what's covered and what's not. And so we want to always check in with our patients about their insurance coverage. So looking at the DPP-4 inhibitors, the Januvia, Onglyza, Tradjenta, Nucynta, how do they rate? Do they cause hypoglycemia? No, they actually don't. Do they cause weight gain? No, they're actually weight neutral. We consider them weight neutral. Are they affordable? No, they are not affordable. Do they lower cardiovascular risk? No, they don't lower cardiovascular risk. They just lower the blood sugar. Can most people tolerate and use? Yeah, they're actually really tolerable. People can use them. They take them once a day. They don't get nausea or GI side effects. So they really are well tolerated by people. They don't even notice they're taking the medication, except for some people get headaches. And so out of 5, what would you all give this medication? I'm going to give it a 3. So you all may, you know, think about it differently. I give it a 3 because of its expensiveness. It's expensive, and also it lowers A1C around 0.5% to 8.8%. But the things I do like about it is it's safe. No low blood sugar, and I like that it doesn't cause any weight gain. And so this is certainly a medication we're going to keep in mind. It's usually not the first medication we start patients on, but it is a medication that we would consider. Okay, let's do another case study. If a patient is on metformin and sulfonylurea, her A1C is 8.4%. And you can just see she's so discouraged. And I'm sure you meet patients like this. They come in, they feel so bad. Their blood sugars are up. Their weight is up. They're trying to eat healthily. They're trying to exercise. Their weight isn't moving. And they're just so discouraged. And so this is another point where we really can interact with people and help them move past discouragement and give them some strategies that will help. So let's just take a look. I'm going to launch a poll question and see what we're going to do. So this is that case study, 44-year-old on metformin and sulfonylurea, really concerned about her weight. What are some strategies that we could enact to help her? All right. Thank you for voting, everybody. So I'm using these terms like GLP-1 agonist and SGLT2 inhibitor. You may not be familiar with them yet, but I want to throw them out there so we get familiar with them, and then we'll keep talking about them throughout this webcast. All right. So take a few more seconds to vote. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close this poll and talk about these different action items. So, patients struggling with weight, what can we do? And I really would encourage you to refer to a dietitian. Patients with diabetes can see dietitians for 2 hours every year. And as I've mentioned before, dietitians are so effective at helping patients make changes in their eating habits, they help improve A1Cs by 1 to 2 percentage point, a visit with a dietitian. So definitely getting her involved in seeing a dietitian, diabetes self-management education is a definite yes. And not just one time, but on an ongoing basis. Very important. Okay. B, suggest GLP-1 agonist. Now, this one I really like, and we haven't really talked about this class of medications yet, but it's the exenatide, liraglutide or Victoza, and there's some others. But these medications actually help people lose weight. And so remember how we were looking at the ADA algorithm? They said, you have two medications, you try a third one, and after the third one, if three medications don't work, go to insulin. So we're still at two. We can add one more. And so I would definitely agree with this GLP-1 agonist. We'll keep talking about this in a minute. 14% of you said increased dose of sulfonylurea. That would be my last choice because we know that sulfonylureas actually enhance weight gain. Sulfonylureas can cause low blood sugar, and when people have low blood sugar, they want to eat more to treat that low blood sugar. So I would really back away on the sulfonylurea, and in truth, I would consider getting rid of that medication because I know it supports weight gain. Okay, D suggests an SGLT2 inhibitor. What is that? Those are those glucuretics that tell your kidneys to release sugar. That's another great choice because those medications actually help with weight management. So far I like A, I like B, I like D. Those are my three. Yes, I agree with you. Now, E suggests starting insulin. I would really be reluctant to start insulin at this point with this gal because insulin is a growth hormone. She's struggling with weight. I know insulin would get her blood sugars down, but I would try another strategy before starting insulin with her to support her weight loss. So that's what I would say. And let's go over that in more detail in the upcoming slides. But I really do thank you so much for looking at those and considering these different poll questions. So I'm assuming you can see my screen. If you can't, send me a note, but I think I figured out a workaround on the screen disappearing. So let's talk about the GLP-1 agonist. Now, I wanted to tell you that there's three different ways of these meds are termed in three different ways. They're called incretin mimetics. So medications that imitate our gut hormones. So incretin is another word for gut hormone. So they're called incretin mimetics, they're called gut hormone imitators, and they're called GLP-1 agonists. All three of those mean the same thing. So if people are using these words interchangeably in describing these medications, you'll feel grounded. You'll know what this means. And GLP-1 stands for glucagon-like peptide 1 agonist. GLP is a hormone made by your intestines. So this medication supports your gut hormones and help them work better. And they actually add synthetic gut hormones to the blood circulation. Let's take a look at how they work. So this GLP-1 effect in humans is really important to review. And knowing that the GLP-1 glucagon-like peptide hormones are actually endogenously created in our intestines. So we make these GLP-1 hormones, and they're released when we eat. This is what's supposed to happen. Let me just clarify that. These GLP-1 hormones tell your pancreas to make insulin. They increase beta cell response. What else do they do? They also suppress your alpha cells from making glucagon. So the pancreas makes insulin that lowers blood sugars, and it makes glucagon that raises blood sugars. And so this hormone, GLP, suppresses the pancreas from releasing glucagon after a meal. Very important. It tells the liver, don't release hepatic stores. So by suppressing glucagon, it suppresses the release of glycogen stores after eating, and it also regulates gastric emptying. So what happens if you release your gastric contents too quickly, you feel hungry again. So this slows down gastric emptying, this hormone, which is very, very important. It promotes satiety and reduces appetite. So this is the role of our gut hormones, our incretins, our GLP-1. This is what they're supposed to do. Now, let me just say that in people with diabetes, they only make 50% of normal amounts of gut hormone. They only make 50% of normal amounts of gut hormone. So if you don't make enough gut hormone, you don't feel full. Your pancreas doesn't squirt out insulin with meals or doesn't squirt out as much as it should. And also, if you don't make enough gut hormone, glucagon might be released from your pancreas after you eat. That's why you'll see a lot of times people with diabetes have high postprandial blood sugars, is because the system is broken and they release too much glucagon after meals and their liver pumps out sugar after eating. It's broken. The system is broken in part because they don't make enough insulin and in part because they don't make enough gut hormone. And so if a person with diabetes doesn't make enough gut hormone, how can we fix that? Well, we fix it in two ways. One way is by giving a DPP-4 inhibitor. Let me talk about that for a minute. So you can see our gut hormone GLP-1 is degraded by DPP-4 within minutes. So DPP-4 is an enzyme. It's an enzyme that breaks down our gut hormone. It's a naturally occurring enzyme because, you know, we have on switches and we have off switches. So when we eat, we release gut hormone, and after a certain amount of time, the enzyme DPP-4 degrades it. But when you have diabetes, you make less of this gut hormone, plus the enzyme that degrades it is hyperactive. So there's two ways to fix this. Number one is that you can inhibit this enzyme. And that's what the DPP-4 inhibitors do. They inhibit the breakdown of our gut hormone because they inhibit the DPP-4 enzyme. So there's two ways to fix this. You can inhibit the DPP-4 enzyme, and that's what Januvia, Onglyza, Tradjenta, and Nucina do. Or you could supplement the GLP hormones. You could give more GLP-1 agonists through an injection. And what injections am I talking about? Well, let's go on to the next slide. I'm talking about Byetta and Bydureon, or exenatide and exenatide XR. These are gut hormone imitators. These are GLP-1 agonists. These are synthetically created gut hormones that aren't as susceptible to being broken down as our own endogenous gut hormone. And so the first one on the market was Byetta. I'm sure you've heard of that. And that required a twice-a-day dosing. But now they've approved exenatide XR, which is a long-acting version you take one time a week. This is so exciting. And now there's pens available in 2015. So you don't have to, for both versions, the twice a day or the long-acting version. The long-acting version originally was a powder with a liquid and you had to mix it up, but now it's in a pen. So both of these are, you know, pretty easy for our patients to take and very effective. But let's just look at the action. It increases insulin release in response to meals, slows gastric emptying, causes satiety so you feel full because there's, the gastric emptying is slowed down. But listen to this. I put this in red. Protects beta cells. The GLP-1 agonist medication have a special functionality of preserving beta cells. And so there's some thought that maybe we should be starting these earlier on in the process of diabetes. Interesting. Protects beta cells. Okay, let's look at efficacy. Decreases A1C by about a 1 percentage point, but really effective at weight loss. So a lot of patients will see their weight go down 3 pounds and more. And as you can imagine, many times when you hear the word weight loss, there is some nausea associated with this medication. It's indicated for type 2s only, but look, you can do it in monotherapy, so you can start a person with diabetes on these formulations, or you can add it on in combination. Here's a once-a-week exenatide extended release by Durion. So this was the first one on the market where you could take once a week. It's 2 milligrams, decreases A1C by 1.6%. Look at the weight loss, 6 pounds. So we were talking about the ideal diabetes medication, and this one already is looking good. It doesn't cause any hypoglycemia, and we see people losing a lot of weight on it. For type 2s only, available in pen, but it is not indicated for anybody with medullary thyroid tumor history. And the rat and animal tests they did before releasing it, they saw an increased risk of medullary thyroid tumors. So proceed with caution in anybody with that history. And there also is a warning of pancreatitis. But the latest studies I have read for this GLP-1 agonist is that it seems not to be increasing pancreatitis or pancreatic cancer. But we still have to warn patients about it. Very, very important. Okay, here's another one. Albiglutide, or also known as Tanzium. This is another GLP-1 agonist or incretin mimetic. Once a week dosing. This is exciting. 30 to 50 milligrams. So generally we might start a little bit lower because of the nausea and letting people get used to it and then go up to 50 milligrams. But you can see it decreases A1C by 1 percentage point and weight by about 2 pounds. So everybody has a different response. It has a pen injector, and this is pretty interesting because it has the powder and the water in one pen, so you have to do this twisting mechanism and shake it up and then inject it. But really nicely put together for patients with diabetes, a once-a-week injection. Again, it still carries the same warning of medullary thyroid tumor and pancreatitis, so we must tell our patients about that. Here's another one, GLP-1 analog, Victoza, liraglutide. So this is actually a once-a-day dosing, time not critical, and here you start at a lower dose, and if tolerated, as far as nausea, go to a higher dose with a max dose of 1.8 milligrams daily. It comes in a pen, and it lowers A1C by 1 percentage point, body weight by 2.5 kilograms. So that's a 5-pound weight loss, which is really significant. And again, the same warning. So these, you can see the market is really getting a lot of these agents involved, because not only do they lower blood sugar, but they don't cause weight gain, and some people see weight loss. So this is a new slide I added last minute. I apologize, but I was reading up on this, and they have also approved liraglutide, which is Victoza, not just for diabetes, but also for weight loss. So it's liraglutide repackaged and called Saxenda. So listen to this. Saxenda and Victoza contain the same active ingredient, liraglutide, but at different doses. The Saxenda, which is for weight loss, is 3 milligrams, and Victoza, as we've mentioned, is 1.8. So Saxenda is approved by the FDA just in December as a treatment option for chronic weight management in addition to exercise and healthy eating. It is approved for adults with a BMI of 30 or greater, or a BMI of 27 or greater who have hypertension, type 2 diabetes, or dyslipidemia. So the same medication for different uses. And so you can see how powerful these medications, the GLP-1 agonists, are at supporting weight loss. But for all of these GLP-1 agonists, we do talk about the pancreatitis warning. So letting our patients know to report any signs right away of abdominal pain, nausea, and vomiting. So it's just out of the blue abdominal pain. Let somebody know. We have to report that. It's a reportable event. We have to let the FDA know about it. Okay. So let's just summarize incretin mimetics. How do they rate the GLP-1 agonists? How do they rate? Do they cause hypoglycemia? No, they don't. Do they cause weight gain? No, and actually we'll see people losing weight. Are they affordable? No, they're not. These medications, since they're new, are really expensive. And so some insurances will cover it, great, but if you have cash pay or people without, you know, good insurance coverage, this will be a $300, I would just say $200 to $300 expense for them. Does it lower cardiovascular risk? No, no data to support that. Can most people tolerate? Yeah, most people can. It is an injection. It does cause some nausea and GI distress. But most people feel like the benefit of weight loss and blood sugar improvement is worth that, and they will stick with it. And also, we talked about it does some beta cell preservation. So this certainly is a medication on my radar, in that for certain patients who are struggling with weight and are really trying to get blood sugars down, it definitely is a medication that we will consider as part of our, you know, figuring out what's the best match for this patient. Okay, let's go on to another patient. We have a 69-year-old male, BMI of 20, well, I changed him to 27. His BMI is 27. He's on metformin 1,000 milligrams twice a day. Now, if you look at your purple card, is he on the max dose of metformin? Actually, he is. So he's on the max dose of metformin and exenatide, 10 micrograms before breakfast and dinner. So he's also on the max dose of that GLP-1 agonist before breakfast and dinner. So he's on two medications, max dose, A1C is 8.1. His creatinine is 1.2. He's had diabetes for 11 years. He's frustrated. So I am going to launch a poll and say, what's next? What could we add to this regimen to improve his blood sugars? Okay, so while you're doing this poll, somebody says, so what's my rating for the incretin mimetics out of the 5-point scale? Well, for the incretin mimetics, I'm going to give them a 4. I'm going to give them a 4 out of 5. No hypoglycemia, no weight gain, but they're really expensive. And I really love them for the beta cell protective qualities. I gave it a 4. And then Lisa asked a really good question about the incretin mimetics, that what if you have gastroparesis? A lot of, you know, so not that many patients have gastroparesis. And gastroparesis means slowing of the digestion of food in the stomach. But if they have a high A1C and they've had a high A1C for a while and they're complaining of bloating, and they have signs of gastroparesis, the GLP-1 agonist is not a good choice for them. You're absolutely right. Good question. Okay, so let's get back to this guy. He's on max dose of metformin and exenatide before breakfast and dinner. A1C is still up, super frustrated. What are we going to do? 70% of you have voted, so I'm going to go ahead and close this poll and share it. I love that 43% of you said refer to RD and diabetes self-management education. Absolutely. You know, as I said, he's had diabetes for 11 years. We want to ask him, when's the last time you saw a dietitian? And many of my patients will say, oh, I saw one, you know, 8 years ago. Well, let's get you into C1, and let's see if we can get you into some diabetes classes or individual appointments with a diabetes educator, because they can also see the diabetes educator on an ongoing basis. Diabetes requires ongoing support, coaching, information. So A is correct. So 14% of you said start basal insulin. And just like the other gal, I'm not ready yet to start basal insulin. It certainly is a thought, but it would be the last choice in my bag of tricks, because I know that basal insulin also might cause some weight gain. So I'm going to explore any other options before I go to that. 43% of you said consider adding a SGLT2 inhibitor. And that is really what's on my radar for this particular patient. Since they're overweight and they're on two meds, I can add one more med before going to insulin if it works. And so I certainly would consider that. So none of you chose bolus insulin. Great job. And none of you chose stop orals, go to basal bolus. You're right. We still have a little wiggle room here with this patient to see if we can try some other therapy. Okay, so I'm assuming that you can see my screen. If not, send me a little love note and I'll make it right for all of you. So here's the SGLT2 inhibitors, also known as glucuretics. Glucuretics, so it helps you release glucose from your kidneys. And as you're losing glucose, you can imagine what's happened to your body weight. You lose weight. So you're losing fluid and you're losing sugar. And so these two together really help to improve not only blood glucose, but also body weight. So this is a glucuretic that decreases renal reabsorption in the proximal tubule of the kidney. So it resets the renal threshold level. So let me just talk about that for a minute. Normally, we release glucose out of our kidneys when our blood sugars are 180 or greater. But when you have diabetes, that threshold is upregulated to 210. And so this class of medication sets that glucose threshold back down to 180. So it tells your kidneys, release the sugar, it's okay. So here's the different medications. We have canagliflozin, dapagliflozin, and empagliflozin. And you can see they all have different dosing strategies, and they're once a day. So for all of these, since we're releasing water and sugar, We have to monitor blood pressure because some patients can get orthostatic hypotension from the fluid loss. We also have to monitor renal function. When you start these medications, you'll notice that the GFR might drop a little bit. That's normal, but it should rebound back up. So we're always looking at the GFR and kidney function for safety in these medications. So it says here, if GFR is less than 45, stop Invokana. If it's less than 60, stop Farxiga. And do not start patients with GFR less than 45 on Jardiance. So these have different different GFR thresholds that we need to be familiar with. And so having this reference available to you can be really helpful. Especially if patients are already on it, I always like to check their GFR and see if it's still safe for them. So side effects include hypotension, urinary tract infection. So now you're collecting all this extra sugar, it's sitting in the bladder, and so there's more potential for not only urinary tract infection, but also genital infections. And so you want to let patients know if you're having any yeast infections in the genital area to let your provider know right away. And, of course, increased urination. Farxiga, in their initial studies, seemed to slightly increase risk of bladder cancer. We're not sure if it's causal or it was just a casual finding. But for now, we're saying avoid Farxiga in patients with bladder cancer. So you can see it lowers A1C 0.7 to 1.5% and lowers body weight 1 to 3 pounds. So, again, we're looking at a medication that helps not only decrease blood sugars, but body weight. And most of our patients with diabetes are overweight and they're struggling to lose weight. And so we want to look toward matching medications to where they're at as far as their goals and their physical presentation. And so this is just a repeat of what I've said before. And so let's just rate these SGLT2 inhibitors. How do they rate? Do they cause hypoglycemia? No, they don't. They won't make your blood sugar go too low. They cause weight gain. No, actually, people lose weight on them. Are they affordable? Nope, they're not. Any new drug is not affordable. So, again, this would be a big out-of-pocket expense if your insurance company doesn't cover it. Does it lower cardiovascular risk? No, it doesn't. Mm-mm. Can most people tolerate? So these are new medications, so we don't have a lot of data yet on tolerability from our patients. But I've had several patients on this medication, and they actually really appreciate it. They've seen their weight come down. And the main thing they complain about is the more frequent urination. So that's the most difficult thing for them. But there's really no GI side effects or any other side effects that they complain about besides the UTIs and the infection and going to the bathroom more frequently. So out of 5, what do you all give this medication? I'm a 4. I'm a 4 out of 5 because I like the safety profile. I like that you can lose weight on it. And I like that it's pretty tolerated, well tolerated by most people. The main drawback for me is this affordability. And the other drawback is also we don't have as many years using it as we have with those other medications. So for any new medication, I always proceed with caution, and I watch it carefully to see how, you know, patients respond to it. Let's just wrap up with 3 other medications that we may not see as much, but they're still out there, and we need to be familiar with them, especially if you're thinking about taking a CDE exam. The CDE exam will ask questions about all the medications that are available. And so the next ones are the insulin sensitizers, also known as the TZDs. These really ran into a lot of trouble in the last 7 years, a lot of issues with them. And so many patients have been taken off their Actos and Avandia, and now we're kind of reconsidering if that is the right choice. So let's take a look at these medications. They really do have a very unique quality, and that is they decrease insulin resistance at the muscle and adipose level. This is really a big deal because type 2 diabetes, patients become very insulin resistant, especially in their muscles. And I want to say this again, and I say it in the first, you know, class on the pathophysiology, but 85% of glucose is used by the muscle. So the more muscle mass we have, the more glucose we burn up. And if our muscles are more insulin sensitive, it's really going to impact and lower our blood sugars. And it also helps decrease free fatty acids. If your adipose tissue can store triglycerides and not resist it, you're going to see triglycerides and free fatty acid levels decrease. So it does have a positive impact on cardiovascular status, these medications. But now let's talk about all the problems. So Actos most recently had a bladder cancer warning that in some studies that it seemed to increase the risk of bladder cancer, especially when used at max dose for over a year. And so many countries have pulled Actos. America still utilizes it, but says anybody with a history of bladder cancer or risk for bladder cancer, avoid this medication. Now, Avandia was restricted access for a long time because they said it increased the risk of heart attack. And after doing some more evaluation, the FDA determined that was incorrect. So the restriction is now relaxed. So Avandia is now available, and it's 4 to 8 milligrams daily, where Actos is 15 to 45. But these medications still do have the major problem of fluid retention. They cause fluid retention, so not indicated for anybody with congestive heart failure. So anybody on these medications newly started, the first thing I look at when they walk in, after I greet them, of course, is their ankles. I want to see if they're gaining fluid weight. And anything over 5 pounds is really worrisome. We might need to change over to a different medication. You can see as far as efficacy, they lower A1C 0.5 to 1%. So it's a benefit, and usually that for that reason, it's not a first-line med. It's usually second or third. It takes 6 weeks to reach its half-life maximum effect. So it's going to take a while for it to start working, and when we discontinue it, it's going to take a while to stop working. It is generic, but even though it's generic, it can still cost up to $100 a month if you're cash pay. So it's not cheap. So how do TZDs rate? Do they cause low blood sugar? Nope, they don't. They cause weight gain? Yeah, they do. A lot of people gain weight on them, and it's fluid weight. And if they have CHF or at risk for CHF, this is not a good disease, a good match. Is it affordable? Well, it's generic, but it's still pretty expensive. Does it lower cardiovascular risk? I have two question marks here, because it can increase risk for CHF because of fluid retention, but it does seem to help with free fatty acids and triglycerides. Can most people tolerate? Well, they can unless they get the fluid retention. The other thing I do want to mention about these medications is they increase the risk for peripheral fractures, especially ankle and wrist fractures. And people with diabetes are at more risk for fractures anyways. So this would not be a good medication for anybody at risk for falling. I just have two more medications to quickly cover. The glucosidase inhibitor known as acarbose or Glycet. I rarely see these, but these medications actually target postprandial glucose because they slow the absorption of carbohydrate in the intestine. And the major side effect with these medications is gas. And it causes flatulence and abdominal discomfort because the carbohydrates are absorbed later in the intestine. And as a result, there's more fermentation of nutrients that takes place. And that fermentation leads to gas. And so start gradually and increase over time. And in case of hypoglycemia, if a patient is on this medication plus sulfonylurea or insulin, we need to treat with glucose tabs or milk because other starches are, you know, blocked by this medication. So we have to be very specific for patients. If they're on this medication plus sulfonylurea or insulin, treat lows with glucose tabs or milk. So does acarbose cause low blood sugar? Nope, it doesn't. Does it cause weight gain? No, it doesn't. Is it affordable? It's becoming more affordable since it is generic. There was some studies that it helped to lower cardiovascular risk, believe it or not. This medication was actually used in the diabetes prevention program, and they had really good results with it. So it's just really patients aren't that comfortable with the flatulent aspect of it, and that's why it really never took off. So let's just wrap it up with our last one is an amylin mimetic. So this means an amylin imitator. An amylin mimetic, known as Semlin. Amylin is a hormone released by our pancreas, but when you have type 1, you make no amylin, and type 2, make a lot less of it. So this medication does help prevent a post-meal rise in glucagon, and it slows gastric emptying and increases satiety. It does cause weight loss. The problem with this medication is that in order to take it, you have to be on insulin. So then you're on insulin, you know, 3-4 times a day, plus you have to take this injection 2 or 3 times a day. So it's very burdensome on the patient to take, you know, 5 or 6 injections. Plus it did cause a lot of nausea, and it does cause nausea. I've heard in the rumor mill that they're working on combining amylin with insulin in one injection so that it would help decrease the burden of taking this medication, but that isn't, I haven't heard anything recently about that, but that would really help solve a lot of problems with this medication. Okay, and the last one I want to mention is a dopamine agonist known as cyclosset. Cyclosset helps increase morning dopamine levels, and that actually does decrease blood sugars and seems to decrease risk of death from cardiovascular events. But the side effects include nausea, vomiting, headaches, and fatigue. And so this medication, I've listed more details on the medication pocket card. We don't see it used that much. It's still pretty expensive. It's weight neutral. It doesn't cause hypoglycemia, but for some reason, it's not being well utilized. Maybe it's marketing. I'm not sure. But I just wanted to mention that to you, that it's out there and available. So the critical points on this webcast, and when we're thinking about medications for our patients with type 2 diabetes, is we want to individualize the glycemic targets and the blood glucose lowering. We want to engage our patients in deciding what medications are best for them, and really kind of blend science and art when determining dosing strategies. Diet, exercise, and education are the foundation for therapy for type 2 diabetes management, and metformin is an optimal first-line drug. We have a lot of data about metformin, but after that, doing combination therapy, the data is limited, so we're still trying to figure out the best strategy to get blood sugars to target. 30% of our patients with type 2 diabetes will eventually require insulin therapy just because their beta cells don't make enough insulin. And the truth is, all treatment decisions should be made in conjunction with the patient and focus on their preferences, needs, and values. And we need to always consider cardiovascular risk reduction. So for some homework for you, I've listed some other self-study case studies that you can take a look at and figure how would you manage this and what would be some strategies to help these patients get their blood sugars to target. And also in the AACE article that I've listed on your resource page, they have a lot of good information on the different profiles of diabetes medications, and this is a nice resource for you. Of course, it's too small to see on the slide, but you can get the original article and take a look at these. I think it's really informative. I want to thank you so much for joining us today. If you have any questions, you can certainly email me, bev@diabetesed.net, or go to our website. And I really appreciate all of your efforts to advocate on patients' behalf to improve glucose control in your setting, because so many times patients are on medications that don't match them, that aren't working for them, and they feel frustrated and discouraged. And our job is to help them get the resources they need, including dietitian, diabetes education, and matching the medications to their lifestyle and preferences. So thank you so much for joining us. I'll sign off now, but I will stay online for any additional questions.